The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in today. And we have a terrific guest on. She was previously with us on Hotel Mars, but we're fortunate to have her, and I'll introduce her in just a minute. But she's going to be with us for the 60-minute, one-hour format. So if you have a comment or a question for our guest, Dr. Lindy Elkins-Tanton, on the upcoming NASA Psyche asteroid mission, make sure you do it within the time constraints of our 60-minute formatted program today for Friday, and we appreciate your paying attention to that. Do remember that our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call us is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient. I'll bring the line up on air as quickly as possible. Again, the toll-free number is our preferred way of communicating, and it is 1-866-687-7223. You can also use email if you're at work, for example, and can't make a call from work. And email for today's show is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also send us a note or comment through our blog, which is at thespaceshow.com. Go all the way over to the far right. You'll see upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed, and that is the archive page for our program. So open it up, and then down at the bottom of that page is where you can give us comments or questions. And as soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of it and can bring your comment or question up for discussion with our guest. And I have one other quick announcement before we move forward. Our Open Lines program on Sunday is starting a half hour earlier than usual at 11:30 a.m. California time. So please make sure you note that. It will be a full two-hour program, but it is starting early, 11:30 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So do remember also that you can find out about our shows by our email newsletter, which is sent out every Monday morning at 6 a.m. If you want me to put you on the list, send me your email address. And then again, it's on the website newsletter, which is center right on our homepage. And if you do go to the website newsletter, make sure you scroll down on it, and you'll see all of the programs we have planned. And we're booking shows into early October right now. And then if you have any questions or show recommendations, please do let me hear from you. I don't follow all of them, but I do follow most of them. And I do appreciate your recommendations. A couple of other quick things, because this is the 60-minute formatted show. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially support the program. And remember, if you do support us and you pay federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're paying California taxes, you get a California deduction as well. We are a California public benefit corporation. Our parent of the Space Show is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out, or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com for a lot more information. And we also have corporate sponsors, and their banner ads go across our website, and I suggest you check out what's underneath or behind those banner ads from time to time, as the sponsors do change their messages. And because this is a 60-minute formatted program, I'm not going to read our sponsor messages, but I do want to thank our sponsors, which include the Integrated Space Plan, the Space Foundation, Orbital ATK, and AIAA. And we're deeply appreciative of their joining forces with the Space Show to help bring you all of these programs and content free of charge. So our guest today is Dr. Lindy Elkins-Taunton, and she is the director of the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, and she is also the PI of the NASA Psyche mission selected as part of NASA's Discovery Program. And her research is on the formation of terrestrial planets and the relationships between Earth and life on Earth, particularly examining the role of volcanism. Her research addresses the chemistry and physics of the formation of terrestrial planets, which projects focusing on planetesimals, the Moon, Mercury, the Earth, rocky exoplanets, and on the processes such as degassing the earliest atmosphere. And a second research effort concerns the relationships between large volcanic provinces and global extinction events, focusing on the Siberian flood basalts and the end of Permian extinction. And it's great to have you back with the Space Show on a full program this time, Lindy. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
So how did you get to being the PI of an asteroid mission? Because in all of what I just read, I didn't get to use the word asteroid once.
Well, the asteroids, of course, are the leftovers from planetary formation. And so if you want to look back in time and see how our planets are formed, the asteroids are one wonderful place to go. The real way that I got involved was that I'd written a paper with my colleagues, Ben Weiss and Maria Zuber at MIT. I'd written a paper about how we think that these small bodies first formed early in the solar system, these little planets we call planetesimals, bodies that were just tens or hundreds of kilometers in diameter, that formed the building blocks of the terrestrial planets that we have today. So I'd written a paper on the theory of that and got an email from some acquaintances at Jet Propulsion Laboratory saying we'd be really interested in talking about whether it's possible to do a mission to test your hypothesis. And that was the beginning of the whole thing. I mean, it certainly didn't seem likely that we'd ever end up with something viable out of that initial inquiry, but then six years later, here we are. So that's how it all began. It began from theory.
So how does it's 46 Psyche, I guess, is the full name of it. How does that test your hypothesis?
It's actually 16 Psyche. It
was 16, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Not at all. It's the 16th asteroid that was discovered. Psyche is a large metal object. It's about 230 kilometers, maybe 140 miles in diameter. So if you plopped it down on Massachusetts, it would span the length of Massachusetts. And its surface area is larger than the surface area of California. It's almost the surface area of Texas. So as small bodies go, it's a big one. And it appears to be made entirely of metal. And that makes it unique in our solar system. It's the only large, relatively spherical object in the solar system that's made of metal. And we think that it's the core, the metal core of one of these planetesimals, one of these bodies from early in the solar system.
Can you tell what body?
No. The rest of that body would have been destroyed and wouldn't exist anymore. But we think that there might have been about 1,000 planetesimals, these small planets, formed very quickly out of gas and dust in the early solar system, orbiting the sun, colliding with each other, many of the collisions becoming accretionary collisions where the bodies stuck together and began to make bigger and bigger bodies until they added up to a body like the size of Earth. But some of the collisions between these planetesimals were destructive. And my friend Eric Asfog, who studies these things, he and Bill Botke have coined the term hit-and-run collisions. And so some of these collisions actually just smacked material off of the target body instead of accreting together into a bigger body. And so we think that's what happened to the parent body of Psyche. We think it was hit say, between 4 and 7 times in a destructive way until all its rocky exterior was knocked off and only the metal core remained.
So when you say metal, or the articles I read say iron, is this 100% identical to iron on Earth?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the sense that every iron atom in the universe is the same, you know, that it is. But we think that it's iron-nickel alloy because we think that's what the core of the Earth and the other planets are. And that's the material, when we have metal meteorites that fall to Earth, that's the metal that they're made of, iron-nickel metal. And then they have a lot of trace elements in them, iridium and palladium and rhenium and cobalt and other trace elements, but they're mostly iron and nickel.
And so so NASA has decided to go test your theory with 16 Psyche. So how does it test your theory? And I understand that they are speeding the launch date up on the mission, and why is that?
Sure. Well, first, just to talk about theories. What we're really trying to answer at Psyche, the fundamental science, the reason that NASA funds this, the reason that we're going to Psyche, is to understand some really basic science about the cores of planets. And so our leading hypothesis is that it is the core of a planetesimal, a failed little baby planet, the way I was describing. But I don't know if this occurred to you while I was describing it or to anyone who's listening, but the idea that that parent body had 4 to 7 destructive collisions and no accretionary collisions, you feel like you're kind of beginning to flip a coin and you're getting heads over and over and over again. You know, the likelihood of that is relatively low. It's not zero. We run lots of simulations, and a lot of the simulations do end up with a body like Psyche in them, but some of them, it doesn't happen. I mean, it has to, it's an unusual occurrence. And so our leading hypothesis that it's a core is already a bit of an unusual thing. And so the biggest thing that we're testing, the biggest piece of science we're testing by going to Psyche is it a core, or is it some kind of metallic material that we haven't really envisioned before? Could it be a big surprise? And that's possible. Maybe it's not the core of a planetesimal. Maybe it is something that we haven't really seen before in the solar system. So that's very, very exciting. That's the most fundamental science that we're going to test.
So what does the mission involve? What does it do when it gets there?
We're going to orbit for 22 months. It's an orbiter.
Uh-huh.
We're going to orbit for 22 months. We're going to measure the composition. We're going to take lots and lots of pictures. We're going to measure whether there's a magnetic field. We're going to figure out what the internal structure is from studying the gravity. And we're going to see for the very first time the morphology, the shape, the topography of a metal body. We've gone, humankind, we've visited rocky bodies and icy bodies and bodies made of gas, and we have never visited a metal body before. And since Psyche has only been seen as a point of light on a camera image, this will be our very first time seeing what it looks like up close.
And how far away is it?
It's in the outer asteroid belt at just about 3 astronomical units, about twice as far away from us as we are from the sun.
So why did they move up the launch date? So I understand they moved it up a year, but that gets it there 4 years closer. Is that years quicker? Is that right?
Oh, great. Yeah, because NASA's been doing actually a phenomenal job of managing their budget and working really hard to get the maximum results out of the taxpayer dollars that we spend. And we had originally been selected to launch in 2022. So trajectory finding, figuring out if we launch in 2022, how do we get to Psyche? That is more of an art form than a science, it turns out. We have lots of computer code that helps us, but we have to explore all the possible parameters, how big a launch vehicle it is, how much propulsion we have, whether we can go by Mars and get a gravity assist. And it turns out the best possible trajectory for a 2022 launch took us 7 years to get there. And that is a long, long trajectory. So the thing is that crews, just going on the trajectory, isn't free. You've got a lot of people working and keeping track of the mission and sending commands and receiving commands and tracking it. So NASA said to us, If we can manage in our budget to let you launch a year earlier, could you find a much shorter trajectory and save us a bunch of money so that we don't have to pay everybody to just monitor the spacecraft while it's in cruise? So that was a great challenge for us. And there's a trajectory expert at Jet Propulsion Laboratory named Gregory Whiffen, and he is the trajectory magician who found I was talking about the 2023 launch all this time. I'm sorry, I was using the wrong year. Originally, we were selected for a 2023 launch that was taking us 7 years. So NASA said, look for 2022. So Gregory Whiffen found this beautiful trajectory in 2022, which actually takes 3.4 years to get there instead of 7 years. And it gets us there just in the beginning of 2026. And so that is actually a huge cost savings, and I have permission from NASA to say proudly that that is saving $100 million. And so that is just fantastic care with the national budget and a lot more science, a lot faster for a lot less money.
So what did the wizard do to cut all that travel time down?
Yes. Originally, we had to go around the sun once and get an Earth gravity assist, and then go out and get a Mars gravity assist, and then arc around to get to Psyche. But now we don't have to go past the Earth. We can go right past Mars, get a Mars gravity assist, and actually get a much faster and clearer path straight to Psyche. So that's what he discovered, and it saves us all that time and all that money.
Do you get to go on a different kind of rocket, or do you still need to use the same kind of rocket? And what launch vehicle are you using for this?
The launch vehicle hasn't been decided yet. What happens is we end up with an expert who is going to get bids on the launch vehicle. It could be an Atlas V. That's a possibility, but it's not yet decided. Indeed, we might get go on a slightly larger launch vehicle than we would have originally. But the other change is we've added an extra solar panel to each side of the spacecraft. We used to have 4 solar panels on each side, which gave us about 17 kilowatts of power at the distance of Earth from the sun. And now we've upped it to 5 solar panels on each side, which is giving us about 21 kilowatts. And what that does is it just allows us to use our solar electric propulsion at a little higher power and get us there a little faster. And so all of those things are factored into the savings. And so we still have a huge savings.
So there's no nuclear power for anything on this. It's all solar.
Nope, it's all solar electric. It's a beautiful, you know, green ecological trip out to Psyche.
So does this tax the distance limitations for solar to go out this far on solar?
No, it doesn't actually. In fact, it's nice to see that this is not going to be difficult to do. And our wonderful industry partner, Space Systems Loral, this is well within family of what they build all the time. So it's quite comfortable.
So you have no intention of harvesting the iron and bring it back to Earth like the Wall Street Journal has maybe suggested, do you?
That's correct. We do not have any intention of this. And it's really important to make it clear that this is not an economic geology mission. This is not a mining mission. This is a fundamental science mission. But why not note, because we're curious humans and we're always interested in these things, why not note that we probably are going to have a space mining future as a species? So how exciting to go see a metal object for the first time and begin to see what it might be like. Look at the surface. Could it be mined? You know, I'm sure people will ask those questions with the data that we return from studying the science of Psyche, which is what we're really going to do.
So, listeners, you can see the Wall Street Journal article if you Google their headline, NASA's latest mission could play havoc with the world's economy. So when you read the article, that headline doesn't have a lot to do with the article, but I guess they think you're going to flood Earth with iron from Psyche, which is worth $10,000 quadrillion. How did you compute
right.
that value?
I did compute that value, and I think that it's roughly correct. What I did, this is according to the metal market prices that were available in January of this year, I took the average composition of a metal meteorite that falls to Earth and just assumed that Psyche was made of that same material, and multiplied out what the mass of each mineral would be if you valued the entirety of Psyche, the whole body. Recall, this is something that's the size of Massachusetts. And so it's iron and nickel and copper. There's a lot of copper in there, and then cobalt and rhenium and palladium and iridium and all the other things that I mentioned. And indeed, it's worth 10 quintillion or 10,000 quadrillion dollars. It's worth a multiple of the Earth's gross domestic product. But of course, if you imagine that if it were possible in some very distant future, because we have absolutely no way to do this now, to bring Psyche back to Earth and sell it, it would be a glut on the market. And I think that's kind of the thing that the Wall Street Journal was imagining. But that is, it's complete futuristic fantasy. But maybe someday it can happen. Maybe someday we can mine metal from the asteroid belt and bring it back and use it as a resource on Earth. I think that would be great. But are we doing that now? Absolutely not. No, we don't have the technology.
Well, they'd have to compute the cost of bringing it back as part of their value, and and that might change the Wall Street Journal's economics. I don't know.
Right. So at the moment, because it would take 100 technology miracles to figure out how to do that, it would be so much more expensive to try than it would be beneficial economically to bring it back. But there'll come a time in the future when we know how to do that.
What is the mass of, what does it weigh?
Oh, I wonder if I have that number handy. Let me just, maybe while I'm looking that up, if you have another question, I can just check.
So how close, what's the closest orbit that comes to Psyche?
Oh, yeah. So we're going to, in a very interesting question about how you set up your operations of the spacecraft around Psyche. We've got an okay sense of what its overall shape is. There's a researcher named Mike Shepard who published a paper in just earlier this year. He used the Arecibo radio telescope to bounce radar off of Psyche, and by bouncing the radar off of Psyche, he's able to actually figure out what its shape is, more or less. And so we use the best shape model that we've got, but we don't know any of the details of the shape. We don't know for sure how many craters there are, whether there are kind of mountains or scarps or cliffs or other things about its shape. And all the things about the shape of the body are what determine how you can orbit it. And so we're going to come in pretty high, and we're going to start at a very high orbit. We're going to refine the shape model, refine the gravity model. Then we're going to drop down to a closer orbit where we can see more and measure more, and we'll refine the gravity model and the shape model again. Then we'll drop down again, and we'll do it even a fourth time is our plan right now. We'll drop down finally to within one radius of the surface. And so that would be about 100 kilometers above the surface, about 60 miles above the surface. And so we'll get actually very high resolution camera photos from there, and we'll also be able to get quite good composition of the surface from there. So that's our plan.
What is the life expectancy of the mission if NASA doesn't extend it?
The mission plan right now is to orbit for 22 months. One of the exciting challenges about Psyche is its spin axis. Like on the Earth, our spin axis goes through the North and South Pole, and it's more or less perpendicular to the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, not perfectly, and that's why we have seasons, as we all know, but more or less the spin axis is vertical. For Psyche, one of the big collisions that it experienced knocked it over, so its spin axis is lying flat in its orbit. So that means that for a quarter of the year, the North Pole faces straight at the Sun, and then the equator is toward the Sun, and then for a quarter of the year, the South Pole faces the Sun. And so we want to orbit Psyche for long enough that we get lighting over the whole body. And because its spin axis is lying down, that takes a lot more time. So we're going to be orbiting for about 22 months. That's the nominal mission plan.
Will the equipment survive? Could it orbit longer if NASA said yes?
Yeah, we think so. We think so. And so our plan at the moment, although this may change, our plan at the moment is for end of mission would be to spiral down closer and closer to the surface, see how close we could get, see how much more information we can get on a finer scale for composition, magnetic field, for what it looks like. The images as we get closer and closer will be amazing, and then eventually we would crash onto the surface. That's what we think the end of mission plan will be.
Carla is in San Diego, California, and she says when David introduced you, he said that you're the director of the Arizona State School of Earth and Space Exploration. And my question is, since you're the PI of this project, do students in your class get to work on this mission?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for asking that question, Carla. And I just feel so passionately about education. So we are involving students in as many ways as we possibly can in this mission. In fact, our very first student intern since NASA selected us started at Jet Propulsion Laboratory for the summer just last week. I got to meet her, a young woman named Rachel. And so students in our classes will get to participate in doing some design and planning and research for the Psyche mission. My own graduate students will, and students who work with all the other collaborators will. In addition, we have some major student collaboration plans, which I'm very excited to have a chance to talk about. Most missions have student interns who work on the science and the engineering, undergraduate students I'm talking about here, students working on their bachelor's degrees. One thing I think is really critical about how we think about our space future as a species is that we need to involve all the different disciplines in the space future. Space future is not just about science and engineering, and it's not just about thinking as a futurist and writing science fiction novels. We need artists, we need theater people, we need sociologists and psychologists, and we need people who work in religious studies. We need every different discipline to be working on what we do in space. And so we're going to have three different kinds of undergraduate interns work with us. And these are people, for two of these categories, these are undergraduates anywhere in the country. We will put out on our upcoming website, we'll put out calls for application when we're ready. People to work on science and engineering, as I said. Also, people to learn about K-12 science outreach and actually get trained in how to do this and make units about science, about space, and about psyche and bring them to schools. And then finally, we'll also have a group of undergraduates who are called art and writing interns. And these could be any undergraduate scientists or students, any undergraduate students anywhere in the world. And we'll be inviting them to produce pieces of art or writing about the Psyche mission process every month as we go through this long process. And we'll be creating online encyclopedias and galleries of the art and writing that they produce. So what I want to impress upon people is that space exploration is for everyone. NASA space exploration is an effort of our nation, and we need to be as connected to everyone in America as possible. And I think that space travel in general, the biggest goal of it is to inspire everyone anywhere on Earth to be bolder in their own lives, to take a bolder step, to have a bigger vision. That's really what it's all about.
Ben is in Atlanta with a question, and he says, is Psyche strictly a NASA U.S. project, or are there other countries contributing instruments or parts to the mission or something else to the mission?
Right. Most NASA missions have got international collaborators who are contributing, especially instruments. That happens, and NASA contributes instruments to the missions that are run by other space agencies outside of the U.S. For Psyche, all of our hardware is designed and built here in the United States. We've got our industry partner, Space Systems Loral, up in Palo Alto, and Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena is our mission manager. We have instruments coming from the Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland and from a consortium between MIT in Massachusetts and UCLA in California. And then our our cameras are coming from a coalition between Arizona State University here in Tempe and Malin Space Science Systems in Southern California. So it's all U.S. Designed and built, but we have international science collaborations. And so we have, in particular, several scientists from Europe who are official members of our science team and will be working co-equally with everyone on the team to understand the data. And we hope to be in welcoming students from all over the world to participate in different ways, particularly in the art and writing internships.
Penny is in Seattle with another question for you. And she says, is Psyche being hit, and are any chunks of metal being thrown off the surface of this asteroid? And if so, is it possible to time your orbiter so maybe you could grab a sample that gets thrown off the surface?
Oh, I wish. Penny, that's a great question. There are groups of asteroids in the asteroid belt that we know to be families. We can tell by the way that they're orbiting that they used to be together in a bigger piece and they were hit by something big and broken apart. Psyche doesn't have a family, so whatever was broken off, it was broken off so long ago that those pieces have all migrated away. We actually looked really hard into the possibility of having a dust collector on the spacecraft so that we could pick up little tiny pieces of Psyche that might be more or less floating above it, just the way you're describing. We were not able to confirm through any ground-based observation that there was dust around Psyche. And in the end, we decided the cost of flying a dust collector without knowing whether we could ever use it just couldn't be justified. And so we had really hoped to go down exactly that road that you're describing, but it looks like that's not going to happen.
What is a dust collector made of? I mean, what would that instrument actually look like?
I gather there are a couple of different designs for dust collectors out there, and I do not know very much about them. But I do know that that sometimes dust and pieces, very small pieces of material, are collected in aerogel, that very, very light gel material that was used to collect the little particles from the comet for, I believe, both Genesis and Stardust used aerogel, if I'm correct. Someone who's listening, I'm sure, can know and correct me on that. And so there are dust collectors that are designed that way, and I think that's the limit of my knowledge on dust collectors.
Adam is in Denver, and he says, David, I'm at work, so I'm not using the telephone. Lindy, I looked up the meaning of the word psyche, and I understand that it's Greek mythology for the wife of Eros, who is a god of love, and I understand that it has something to do with making a mere mortal into the goddess or something like that of the soul. So I'm trying to understand why the soul would be solid iron. Is that trying to tell us something about love, maybe, that the Greeks knew about that we didn't know? Or why Psyche, if my mythology book is correct?
You are so correct. There was the very first time that the Psyche myth was written down in a way that we can now read it is in a book by Apuleius that's actually called The Golden Ass, and it's actually quite a good read. And indeed, Psyche was a mortal woman who she and Eros fell in love, and she was then made into a goddess. And Eros and Psyche later had a child whose name was Pleasure. and Psyche does mean the soul or breath, the breath. And so how did Psyche become named Psyche? This is actually one of my very favorite stories in all of science, and I'm really excited to be able to tell it. In the early 19th century, scientists who studied the planets had come to think, or astronomers who studied the planets had come to think, that there really should be a planet between Mars and Jupiter, that there was a gap in our planetary system, and they thought they had an algorithm, a calculation that said that there should be a planet there. Turns out later that calculation wasn't correct anyway, but they decided they were going to search out and find that missing planet. And they formed a group of European astronomers, and they named themselves Die Himmelspolizei, the Celestial Police. And they called themselves that because they were going to set right and set order to the solar system by finding that missing planet. And so they all went back to their observatories and started looking. And so first they found Ceres, the big asteroid Ceres, and that's why it's number one. It's the first one that was ever found. And then they found asteroids number 2 and 3 and 4 and up through number 15. And then an astronomer at the observatory in Naples, Italy, found the 16th asteroid and named it Psyche. Now, all of those asteroids are named after figures in mythology. And so the fact that it was Psyche, I don't know exactly why he chose Psyche, but he was a part of the celestial police trying to set right to the solar system. In the end, they realized that there was no planet there, just many, many small bodies that looked like stars, and that's what they're called asteroids, because they look like stars when you look at them through the telescope. And at that time, they had no idea that Psyche was made of metal. In fact, they did not have any way of knowing the composition of the asteroids. It's only really in the last 10 years that enough data and information has come back that it's convinced us that Psyche is made of metal. So the metal part is new, and the name is old.
So the founding astronomer, the naming astronomer, may have had nothing to do with the fact that it's metal, because they didn't know that.
Exactly.
The bottom line.
They had no idea.
Interesting. How many have been discovered? Where did the numbers go up to now?
Oh, what are we up to? I think we're above 50,000, but I should know that number, and I don't. Maybe there's somebody who's got the internet handy who can discover that number more quickly than I can, but it's tens of thousands, if not above that.
All in the asteroid belt.
That's right. And then there are many other small bodies elsewhere in the solar system.
Amazing. Is there any use for Psyche other than for science and education right now? I mean, I guess that's the main purpose of wanting to go and explore it, correct? There's no future use plan for it. I would imagine.
Not right now. Okay, so my Googling is saying that the asteroid belt is estimated to have more than 1 million asteroids in it, but I don't actually know the number that have been discovered and named, or discovered and numbered, because most of them don't have names yet.
So to rephrase my question to make it a little clearer, you've not heard or seen that any of the commercial-oriented mining
right.
companies have set their sights on Psyche.
No, and it's interesting to me that, and I know a number of people at some of these commercial asteroid mining companies that are planning and thinking about how to do this. No one's even talked to me about it. Most of them are quite focused on water as being the first thing to try to mine from the asteroids. Water is useful, of course, to keep humans alive and also to make rocket fuel, and it's much easier to mine, we think, than metal. And can be used in situ without having to bring it back to Earth for further processing. So I don't think anybody's thinking too hard about how to do metal yet, but it is coming. It's on the page. It's a little lower down than water.
So Sarah is in Tucson, not too far from where you are, and she said, if this was a core of a planet, can you sort of put the size of Psyche in perspective to what we believe the size of the core of Earth might be?
Oh, to the size of the core of Earth.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Let's see. How do I answer that? Earth and Mars and the Moon and Venus and Mercury all have got metal cores that make up different fractions of the overall planet. For the Earth, the radius of the core is roughly half the radius of the whole planet. And so for Psyche, if Psyche is the whole core of its planetesimal, its parent body, and only the rock was knocked off perfectly, leaving only the metal behind, then it would have been an asteroid about the size of Vesta. But it could be a smaller piece of a core, since metal might have been knocked off along with rock, and then it's hard to say how large the parent body could have been.
But Earth's core would be much bigger than Psyche.
Oh, my goodness.
Many times larger.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, many, many times larger. How many times larger? 50 times larger in radius, something like that?
Okay, so as we go into the outer planets like Pluto, for example, I'll consider it still to be a planet. Mm-hmm. Does it have a core like this, and would we be talking comparable size there?
If it has a rocky core, which it almost certainly does, it's a mixture of ices and heavier material.
Right.
I think it's not still fully determined whether the rock and metal constituents differentiated into a purely metal part and a purely rock part. It could be in the outer planets that the rock and the metal never heated up to the point where the metal drained away into the center and they're still mixed together, rock and metal. But a further question is, how much metal was there out there compared to rock? It could be that large amounts of metal are really only existing in the inner solar system with the terrestrial planets, and it could be that the outer planets have mostly rock and ice. But that is not fully determined. That's not something we really understand yet.
In looking at the many different exoplanets that are being found all the time, can we tell if they have metal cores like this? Are we able to get that type of information with our technology so far? And if so, is this really rare among exoplanets, or is this more and more common?
There are a lot of scientists who are trying to understand the structure of the interior of exoplanets. So what we can learn about exoplanets right now is for some of them, we can learn both their radius and their mass. And so if you know the size of the exoplanet and you know how much it weighs, then you know how dense the material it is that makes it up, if that makes sense. So if you have, for example, something that's super, super heavy but very, very small, then you know it has to be made of dense, heavy material. And so by knowing about what the density of rock and metal and ice are, people try to use the bulk density information about exoplanets to figure out what they're made of, how much ice, how much rock, how much metal. And the fascinating thing is we're beginning to discover some exoplanets that are so dense that we think they almost have to be made mostly of metal. And so how would that happen? Now, this is not a small psyche, the core of a little planetesimal. This is something that is larger than the Earth and seems to be made of mostly metal. And so there is a lot. We have to learn about all the different ways that planets can be made. And I'm hopeful that things that we learn by looking at our only little metal world in our solar system will help us to understand what these big, dense planets could be orbiting around other stars.
I know they're starting to be able to maybe learn more about an exoplanet by understanding what's in the atmosphere, and I think there's a couple that are prime targets for that. Would the atmosphere, being able to study the atmosphere, would it give any hint or lead to a conclusion that you've got a metal core like this?
There is some hope that we would be able to see how the atmosphere interacts with the solar wind from their star and begin to understand whether they have a magnetic dynamo, if they have a magnetic field. And if it's a big, dense planet, really dense, then that magnetic field would almost certainly be made by circulating liquid metal the way it is on our Earth. So Psyche's all cold and solid by now, but the cores of our terrestrial planets are partly solid metal and partly liquid metal, and it's that liquid moving, mixing metal that makes our magnetic field. So if we can look out at exoplanets and see evidence of a magnetic field, then we can be pretty confident there's metal there.
Would it be easy to land on Psyche?
I think easy is a difficult question. I mean, to think about the Rosetta mission and the courage of landing on the comet and how hard that was. It should be a bit easier on Psyche because Psyche is much, much bigger than that comet and it has more gravity, so that can help to stop bouncing. But that would be that, you know, landing on a metal object, never been done, and so I think it wouldn't be easy.
Would you be able to learn a lot more about it, were you landing on the object and just being an orbiter?
we could definitely take other instruments and learn other things about it. And maybe there'll be another mission someday to do that. The challenge of doing a mission like that is we'd have to develop technology that we don't now have. And so it's very difficult to know ahead of time how much it's going to cost to develop something that doesn't exist yet. And so trying to stay within the cost cap and make sure that this is an affordable mission required that we not rely on any technology miracles to do it.
Who sets the cost cap? Is that you as the PI or does NASA?
No, that's NASA and Congress.
So Congress actually sets the cost cap per mission?
No, Congress approves the NASA budgets,
right,
and in some cases the distribution of the money within NASA for different programs. So that's about my limit of understanding on that. But no, the principal investigators do not get to decide how much we get to spend.
So this launches in a little more than 4 years from now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we're following this as interested amateurs, for example, what goes on during this 4+ years? And as PI, what is your role over the next 4 years?
Oh my goodness! So this is so much fun and so exciting what we're going through right now, because for me it's the first time, and so NASA has divided up the way it runs missions into different phases. And so what we went through after we were selected for as a finalist, one of five finalists, we went through what's called Phase A, which is preliminary analysis, where we're trying to make a story for the mission that really holds together, where we can demonstrate that the science instruments we're going to fly will absolutely make the measurements that we need to answer our questions, and where we can demonstrate that the plans we have for building the spacecraft are feasible and will absolutely support the instruments, and we've got the team and the trajectory and all the other things. And so that resulted in about 1,500 pages of writing and planning, and a lot of hardware work actually too. So now we're in Phase B, which is called the definition phase, and really what we're doing is going back and checking all of that, working our schedule, figuring out exactly who we need on every team and what all our dates are going to be for all of our reviews, and making sure that we've got everything planned and formulated perfectly. And then we'll go into phases C and D, which are design and development, and take us right up through the build and launch. And then finally is the operations phase. And so what we're looking at right now is just still being in the planning stage, but we are doing some risk reduction activities, doing a few hardware things early to make sure they work perfectly, going over all the processes for working together between JPL and Space Systems Loral, planning our software, things like that.
When do they actually start building the orbiter?
Little bits of building are starting already, but most of it is going to be starting in next year.
And as PI, do you travel over to Mountain View to check it out and to see how they're building
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I do. So I'm not an engineer, but I have built things, and I've machined metal, and I know something about composites, and so at least it's not lost on me, the processes, and I spend a lot of time talking with my team and making sure that all the decisions are being made right. Right now, what it looks like for all of us is multiple teleconferences every week. We have a leadership teleconference. We have a teleconference that goes with NASA headquarters and the people who help us manage the mission at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. And then we have an engineering telecon every week, and we look at all the action items from last week and how far we've come and what we need to do next. Then we've got risk assessment meetings and monthly management reviews. So it's lots and lots of meetings that are actually very, very well designed to, in a project management sense, to keep the project moving forward correctly. So there's nothing useless or wasted time about this. And then every other week I go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory for several days to meet with people on the team and have face-to-face. And then periodically I go out to Space Systems Loral or over to somebody who's building an instrument, and then we'll have regular science team meetings. So there's all kinds of travel back and forth. We use all sorts of technology for communications, and it seems to be moving very nicely right now.
So a listener to the show who is deeply committed to commercializing space, for example, might hear all of this and say, ah, now we know why government projects cost so much money. Look at all the bureaucratic meetings and all of this stuff that they have to go to. The private sector would never, ever do anything like this. So you did say all of this is efficient and needed. So is it a bureaucratic world, or, you know, if this were a public-private partnership, for example, do you think it would be unfolding in a similar way?
Well, of course, it is a public-private partnership. We're partnering with Space Systems Loral. They're a private company, and our instrument providers, some of them, are private companies. And so I know when you say the word meeting, people immediately think bureaucracy, but I don't know another way to communicate better than face-to-face talking and asking questions. And so the reason that it takes a lot of time and a lot of talking and a lot of action items and a lot of care is that it has to be fail-safe. You know, this is not the same as building a clock that when it breaks, you buy a new one. This is something that's got to fly by itself for 10 years and not fail. And so I'm actually really impressed with this process. This has been worked out by NASA and by NASA's partners over a number of decades to put in the correct number of reviews and oversights and ways to double check and triple check that things are being done right. So I think it's actually surprisingly efficient how quickly we get things done. And this from a person, me, who is obsessed with how teams work together. You know, no matter what we're doing as humans, we're working in a team. And so having teams where everyone is empowered to speak up and everyone listens and respects, so that if someone finds that something's going wrong, they are going to tell us right away and we're going to fix it. They're going to be rewarded for that. You know, we work really hard on that. And so I actually think it's a really good and efficient system.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for calling in. How are you today?
I'm good. I wanted to ask about the camera. Because now that you talk about this, I realize that this is going to be by far the best camera we've ever had out there taking pictures of an object. And it's a metal object. And there's probably going to be all kinds of surprises, just like there was with Rosetta.
Right.
Are we going to get a whole bunch of awesome photos? I think we are, but
yeah.
I just wanted to hear about that.
Hi, Kim. Thanks so much for calling in. Yes, 100% yes. So this is Arizona State University, my university, teaming with Mail and Space Science Systems, who I think are by far the most experienced camera builders for space. And so we're going to have a really good camera out there, and it's going to have a series of filters on it so that we can look. We have a clear filter, so we look at all the filters, so we look at all the colors at once, and then we'll have different individual wavelength filters so that we can even learn more about composition through the wavelength filters. And we are committed to putting these images up for the public on the web absolutely as fast as we can. This is something I feel really strongly about. If we're running a nationally funded mission, then the data has got to be out there as quickly as possible. So some data needs to be post-processed to make sure that it is correct and can be used. But with the photos, in some cases, we think we're going to be able to get them up on the web within a half hour of receiving them from the deep space network. And so I'm really excited about that because, as you say, every time we go into space, we get... You must be near a train.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I don't know how to cover the speaker or anything.
Well, I want to add that because we've never seen a metal world and we don't know what it's going to look like before these pictures start coming back, as we're beginning to approach Psyche during cruise, we're going to run an international competition for the Psyche appearance, and we're going to invite everyone who wants to send in art that depicts what they think a metal world's going to look like, and then we're going to see who's right once we get the pictures back.
Were there a lot of special considerations about how you take pictures of something that's made of metal? Is there problems with reflections and things like that?
We're not expecting it to be too shiny because it will have been bombarded by space weather for a very long time. but we don't really know. And so, what we will be able to do is take pictures from many angles. And so if there is a shiny angle, we'll be able to avoid it just like we can with our regular cameras. And so there's a lot of discussion about, exposure time and angles of taking the images. And there will be two imagers, and we'll even be able to get a topographic map that way. So I think we're going to have a lot of flexibility, which is the key thing.
Great. Okay, thank you. Thanks for your questions.
Thank you, Kim. Listeners, there is possibly time if you still want to call us, and the number is 1-866-687-7233. Excuse me for that. What about the mission, if you could look at the whole thing, what could you tell us is the most exciting about it to you?
I have two things that are the most exciting to me. One is the fundamental science. We're going to go out there and see. This is real exploration. This is a kind of object humankind has never seen before. And so I am extremely excited about going out and seeing what a metal world looks like and discovering whether it's a core or something we've never even imagined before. That would be so exciting. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is the hopes I have for spreading interest and involvement worldwide. I believe things like this distract us from the difficulties and the politics of the everyday and make us better people by looking out toward a bigger group goal together. And that's the other thing that I really hope for and find exciting.
Well, they definitely distract us in a better way. That doesn't take much to do that, does it?
Possibly not.
Does it excite your students as much as it does you?
I think so. I constantly get requests to please let me work on PsyQ project. This is so exciting, so exciting. And we've had tremendous response in the press and from the public about this. People are really intrigued by the idea of seeing a new kind of world. And so I'm hoping that really stays and keeps going. And I should let people know that I'm on Twitter, and we've got a Psyche Mission on Twitter and on Facebook. And soon we're going to have a website up here at ASU. There's already a Psyche website, a one pager up at Jet Propulsion Laboratory and at NASA headquarters. And so, connect with us through the internet, and we're going to keep building on the technology and how much information we can send out to people. We're even going to have a mobile app so you can keep up with the mission. So we hope that the excitement will just keep spreading.
So you're really working the PR on Psyche even this far in advance.
Yeah, because of the inspiration aspect of it. You know, I've got nothing to sell here. This isn't a company. This is an amazing exploration done by a big team of people, and we would love for everyone to feel like they're a part of this team.
We are at the one-hour point. What should we have talked about, or what should I have asked you that I have omitted or not even known enough to ask you about?
I actually think these last bits were the most important bits. You know, connect with the team. Tell us what you think about the mission. Pretty soon you'll have an opportunity to send in your artwork and get students involved, and just hoping that this is a force for good in a number of ways.
When you get your website up, if you let me know, I'll announce it on the program.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
And I'll go back and put it in with the archives on this particular program. Can we stay in touch with you and check with you from time to time on how it's doing?
Yes, please. I would enjoy that very much. And I really appreciate your interest and time and that of all of our listeners.
Yes, and we're looking forward to it. It'll be really interesting to see something new for the very first time. And I guess if they could live stream it, it would be better, but that's probably not going to happen.
It's going to be a little far away for that, but we'll put the images up absolutely as fast as we can as soon as we start getting them.
We'll look forward, and if you find a happy face, don't hide it, okay?
So. That's right. Psyche, the soul, exactly.
That's right. So, Lindy, thank you, and we will for sure stay in touch with you on the progress of Psyche between now and its launch date and its mission going out there. And we look forward to covering it over the next several years with you. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for your interest and your time. I hope you have a great day.
You too. And listeners, that's it for today. So remember, open line starts at 11:30 a.m. on Sunday, 30 minutes early. Thank you all for listening. Special guests to our special thanks to our guest, Lindy, to all of you who emailed us. Everybody have a great weekend coming up. Goodbye from the Space Show.